Spiegel and Holmes, afternoons on the Score.
If you maybe put him in a different situation last year, I think he could have been rookie of the year. You know, what Kingsbury did with Jaden Daniels at the Redskins, and what Bo Nix did out with Sean Payton in Denver. So maybe get a different.
I feel like this people system, around these him. Coaches will be better for him last year. You know, obviously your coach doesn't even make it through
there's
the season.
So it's much just, turmoil going on
it's
there.
A lot of turnover.
That goes back to the Lovie thing. It's been the last 13 years since they got rid of Lovie. It's been that way every year. There's been no consistency in the coaching department, and it's not the players' fault. It's just the way it goes. Well, maybe it is the players' fault because they haven't won, so they can't keep a coach. But Ben Johnson's the man. I love that hire. I think he'll do a great job with Caleb. They got some talent on the sign some guys up front to protect Caleb, and they have always had the receivers, so I think that's going to be a good thing for
him. It's Brian Urlacher. He had thoughts on the Bears. I do wonder if he's actually watching them, but you know, it kind of doesn't matter if he is or he isn't.
He likes Ben Johnson. He's
Bears royalty.
Brian Urlacher?
Yeah.
Yes.
Be nice if Ben Johnson turns into Bears royalty.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say, that's quick. But I guess, you know, the newly crowned king.
Tuck.
Is, you know, if you're the new, like you take over King Charles in England, he's English royalty.
Yes.
I guess he always was because he was a prince,
mm-hmm.
the whole thing.
Yeah.
But any hoodles.
He wasn't prince, but he was a prince.
It is easy to like Ben Johnson. Doesn't take much for you to listen to that guy, watch that guy, and get impressed. And we all are impressed with Ben Johnson. And I think focus understandably has shifted to the quarterback because there are not going to be as many excuses as there have been for Caleb Williams this fall.
Well, there are already people who are looking, like saying, all right, now all of your deflector shields are gone. All of the excuses are gone. Now it's on you. And I'm not sure that's entirely fair, but I do understand wanting to see improvement because, as Olin has said multiple times, they invested in you. So it's now time that you reciprocate with blood, sweat, and tears, time, like all of that stuff as an investment in them so that they know that they can put good people and good things around you and know that you're going to put in the work to try and make yourself a better player.
They're buying into you, right? That's the message. They're buying into you, buy back into them.
That's the whole thing, man. That's the offseason. And so far, so good. Everything that we've heard in terms of work habits, accepting the difficult coaching.
Yes.
All of it.
Doing all the work like under center, even before Ben Johnson started camp, so he could be more comfortable with what the play action stuff is going to look like.
How about a few weeks ago, we gathered all the intel. He is doing all the film work he can with Ben.
And then with Case.
And he's doing extra film work with Case Keenum. And he's doing extra film work with the skill position guys outside of his work with Case Keenum. He's beating people into the building. He's leaving later than other people are leaving the building. So far, so good for Caleb's offseason.
Yeah, and in trying to figure out, because look, we've had this discussion with the Bears fan on the Score airwaves since the season ended on whether or not Caleb's season, like how would you look at it? How should it be framed? My feeling has been, I thought he did pretty well. And I know that there are numbers that don't support that. And I know that just some of the cosmetic numbers might make it look a little bit better than it was, you know, a low touchdown interception ratio, the fact that he did go over 3,000 yards passing last year, all of that stuff. But there were definitely moments when you went, I thought he would be farther along. And then you try to figure out, was he not farther along because this place was an absolute mess last year?
That's football. That's football conversation and trying to figure out what's what. So that's why it goes back to the beginning of the conversation here about the excuses. It's not like all the excuses are gone and it's 100% on him, but that scale has definitely tilted to, if you wanted to say it was 55 or 60% on him, it's going to be 85 or 90% now. Something like that. where you've got still everybody else needs to do their part, but he's much better equipped than ever before. And one of the things we got to figure out is why he takes so many damn sacks. 68 of them, to be exact, and they're not all of those were on the offensive line.
So check this out. The Athletic Football Show with Robert Mays and Derek Klassen, and our guy Michael Beller is one of the producers on that, by the way. They did a whole thing on guys coming into their second year, the quarterbacks that are coming into their second season, of which Caleb is one of them. And I think that there are some really interesting football thoughts here. And we love Robert and Derek. Robert is a frequent guest on this station, and he's terrific. But I, as someone who kind of felt like Caleb does need to be graded on a curve a little bit, I thought it was interesting to hear these guys kind of break it down and give me some different thoughts on how the season went and using some statistics to back it up. This is what they had to say about Caleb and the sack problem.
That's what makes it so difficult to properly contextualize what Caleb Williams' rookie season was, because no matter what angle you're looking at this from, some of it is on him and some of it is on the situation, and that's never going to change no matter how you try to spin this.
And that's where the slippery slope with this stuff can kind of come in, is like you can tell yourself that because there were so many of the bad plays, that even on the clean plays, he isn't going to play necessarily the right way because he just feels like something is going to go wrong. And we've seen this, like these vacillations with quarterback performance year to year because certain guys do this. Like Derek Carr has been this way for a lot of his career, where it was like when there were years where he felt like he was going to get pressured more, he just doesn't play as well, even on the clean plays. But on years where he feels like he's going to get protected really well, he actually plays even better on the plays where he's getting hit, because he just, there's an overall confidence to his game. And I think we saw that a little bit with Caleb Williams last year. But even that film example was really instructive with him specifically with turning down the dig route. Like, for as many things as I think Caleb Williams still does really well, I think some of the things that he's always going to struggle with are seeing and throwing the middle of the field the way that some of the elite quarterbacks do. That was true coming out of college. And then the extended sacks, like him getting the unblocked pressure, that's just like, that's a scheme thing. That's the offensive line, all that stuff. But those, him taking 8 extended sacks, you know, it's probably not going to be 8 every year, but it'll probably be at least 4 or 5 every year where he's making one sack a month at least. That's just going to piss you off as a Bears fan.
And I wonder how much that's true in an offense where Ben Johnson is, again, articulating all this stuff to him in the right way, articulating where your options are and where your outlets are. I think that's what was so obvious about Jared Goff and this version of Jared Goff, is that he understood where his outlets were all the time. And that's not something you could always say about Jared Goff. So I do think that is something you can get better at in an offense like this. I think the sack problem is probably always going to be there to an extent, but I do think the change in situation can help it at least a little bit. And the sack thing is, it's one of the biggest issues, but it's not the only issue. Like, there are other things about what he was as a player last year that I do think are a little bit of a cause for concern. The deep passing for the first half of the season was like historically bad. It was really, really, really bad. And again, I think it goes back to a confidence thing. When you watch him throwing the ball on those plays, he has zero confidence that they're going to be completed. Like, they are truly just prayers every single time.
And they threw a million of them. Nobody threw down the field more than Caleb Williams. So he's being asked one way or another to do it more than anyone in the league. And also he sucks at it. And so when you continue to suck at it, it's like, how is he supposed to get more confidence in it?
Now, inside of this conversation, the guys brought up something I thought was really interesting. The idea of, because Robert went back and he watched all the plays, because that's what Robert does. And he was saying that he kept seeing the concept of DJ is supposed to be running a clear out route, like a clear out dig, while Keenan Allen is the guy that's going deep downfield, and that they would end up in the same, at the same depth at the same time before DJ would run the clear out. So it kind of doesn't work because the DBs are like, okay, so we don't have to bite on this route because you guys are in the same place and I can just hand this guy off to this guy and everything's fine. Like, he was talking, like, conceptually, the stuff that he was seeing the offense do made no sense and offered itself for Caleb to not look as good as maybe he could have.
Interesting. Yeah, it makes sense compared to when you think about what we saw last year. There were definitely times where you saw multiple targets in the same area. Maybe the timing of that pass and the bad design all goes together. The extended sack stat, I have not heard. Like specifically putting that on the quarterback, the extended sack, like extended the play and still ended up taking a sack, is interesting. Like if you're extending the play, then you should probably make sure to get rid of it or give yourself a chance to make a play downfield or what have you. So that was one thing. And yeah, those deep balls, man, it was historically bad, and it seemed like it. It fit the eye test in that whole first half of the year.
In the eye test, it wasn't close.
No.
Like, you're seeing him miss, and it's not like, oh, man, he just had it. No, that ball went over that guy's head by 5 yards.
And maybe he didn't have confidence in the route tree, didn't have confidence in his spot there in the pocket, and that's kind of stuff. Some of the kind of stuff we're going to have to see be better.
All right, so there's more. And Robert kind of went into it a little bit on one of the other things that is a cause for concern and maybe a cause for hope, considering the type of plays that were made by the guys who catch the ball.
One of my biggest experience, I feel like I have this experience every time I go back and watch the Bears, is at some point by the second or third quarter, I'm like, why is Keenan Allen down the field as much as he is?
It blows makes absolutely my mind. No sense. Which guys were on which routes absolutely never made sense. And I think that gets back to the structure of it all as well. But so the down the field stuff was always bad. But even let's just take away the down the field options. A stat I looked up, because if you look at his overall numbers for the season, he was 31st among 36 qualified quarterbacks in EPA per dropback. He was 35th in success rate. This was an abjectly bad year, no matter how you slice it. And even those numbers are propped up by how efficient at times the catch and run and the screen game were for this offense. They got some really big gains on underneath throws because I think some of that stuff was well designed, and I think the players' skill sets are conducive to that. So I was curious, okay, let's kind of zero in here and look at throws just beyond 5 yards. So not even deep throws, but not underneath throws. Where does he fall? The only guys who had a lower EPA per dropback, so this removes all sacks too, by the way. The only guys who had a lower EPA per dropback on throws beyond 5 yards last year than Caleb Williams were Cooper Rush, Gardner Minshew, Daniel Jones, and Anthony Richardson. He completed 51% of those throws beyond 5 yards last year. Only Cooper Rush and Anthony Richardson had a lower completion percentage. So the sacks are the biggest issue. But there is not, that's not the only issue. There's still stuff going on here that I think there are lingering problems that are worth worrying about. I guess that's what I would say.
It's a whole new world now, man. That makes all the sense in the world. That's horrifying, the company he keeps in those stats from the rookie year in terms of the percentage on 5 yards plus. But the way this offense is going to be designed now this year is going to be completely different in terms of timing and targets and opportunity for the targets to do something after they catch it. And Caleb, those numbers will have a chance to be much, much better.
There's something really important in what Robert said there, because what Robert says is what the coach says. When he brings up looking at the list of EPA, we know that is a big thing for Ben Johnson, that is one of his go-to stats.
Yep.
And Caleb found that out as they started to get to know each other football-wise.
I mean, I think it just comes down to details, accuracy details. That doesn't just mean, you know, physically and things like that. That means, you know, being decisive and being accurate mentally and sharp mentally. And just being on top of it. So, you know, I think that starts from it, the decisiveness. And then, you know, when you get out there and, you know, when you're decisive, and everybody plays a lot better when you're decisive. And there's, you know, the QB position is when you're on the field is played in gray. And so having everything else that I can have in black and white is a part of that. So, you know, that part. And then, you know, when you get on the field and you're decisive, you go out there and you rip and, you know, you're more accurate with the ball. You get to place it where you want. You get to go out there and, you know, make checks and be clear minded. So that's the goal. And, you know, we'll work towards that and working on Ben's EPA.
Ben's EPA.
Yeah.
That's the one he brought up. right from the get-go, that quarterback performance is a better indicator of winning in the league than turnover margin. And EPA is the simplest way to look at it.
And that, to me, it's significant that that's the lens with which Robert was looking at Caleb through, is through the EPA in that situation per dropback. Mm-hmm. And him being ranked 31st is problematic. It's not all negative, though. Good vibes, Bay. I got some for you.
Yeah, because I don't even know that the other stuff was negative.
No,
as much
it's just
as it
facts.
It's just facts, and we got to be able to live in the facts as you want a quarterback to be great. But yeah, give me the good stuff.
There are some positives as the Athletic Football Show sees it, and here's one of them.
When he actually decided to play like USC Caleb Williams, it was awesome. Like when he got outside of the pocket and was able to do some of the weird just flipping his hips and making skyhook throws and all this weird stuff. It was really good. And I think he was a good scrambler once he got a little bit more decisive, once he started playing. And then to me, there are moments where he can be a little bit too jumpy in the pocket, where he runs himself into pressure. But I thought overall his pocket management mechanics actually did impress me the more I watched. Like, he will do a really good job of like, okay, pressure off the right side, one big hop step to my left, and then two more quick steps to reset, and then I can make a throw. And he just, it felt like he had such a good idea of how to do that. And also, it's a small thing. He protects the ball really well in the pocket. Like, he'll pull it away from where he knows the free rusher is and stuff like that. Just little stuff where it's like the good guys know how to do that. And so the fact that a lot else was bad is really frustrating, but the good guys know how to do stuff like that.
I'm so glad you said this because it makes for such a weird conversation. Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about or seen another quarterback who gets sacked at an astronomical rate but has good pocket awareness?
Dude, okay. So honestly, younger career Joe Burrow was like this, where he did move around the pocket and had good escapability.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a really good one.
He would just hold the ball and take sacks anyway. So it's, you're hoping that he is something like that. And then even then, Joe Burrow kind of finally fixed that. You know, it took 5-6 years, but he's finally there.
All right, that's really good. I like that because that makes sense, that all those sacks that he took and dealt with, but I do walk away thinking that the kid has pretty good pocket presence. He's just got to get rid of it there towards the end instead of going for the USC stuff that Derek's talking about so often. Sometimes he wants to do that. But I did feel like the way he moved around the pocket was good. So I love that conversation. Obviously, the Burrow comp gives you some confidence, too.
The Burrow comp, I also think there's a little bit of Russ, early Russ in there, too, with some of the ways that Caleb could move inside the pocket. I would add, if I were sitting in the room with Derek and Robert, I would add, though, that there were times where it looked like the pocket wasn't dirty. And Caleb
acted like the pocket was dirty.
Yes. And if that's something that he can, and that might be a byproduct of being sacked a lot too. You know what I mean? Like that could definitely be something that is on his mind because of the way that he has been hit and defended. But that's one of those things I'm like, there's more yards out there for him in some of those if he just climbs the pocket instead of vacating the pocket.
Well, see, right there, and you said it, climbing, you know, not trusting the middle of his offensive line, understandably, and not being able to stand strong, let alone climb, you know, I could understand why it might look like that sometimes.
And I think that the stuff that he was doing at USC, I think that there were times, like, I think that some of this is learned behavior where it's like, ah, you know what? This play broke down. There's some space out here. I'm going to go out here and I'm going to buy myself another second. And with that other second, I'm going to throw the ball 65 yards down the field and we're going to score. And you can't do some of that. You can do a little bit of it. You can't do some of that in the NFL on a regular basis.
Look at my partner rolling around in his home. Where were you listening? Home? Yeah. On the bike?
No, I was listening at home.
Rolling. He's doing work for you people. Do you hear this, listeners? Lawrence Holmes is doing God's work, listening to Hardcore Football Podcast, bringing you the snippets and enlightening you as to what the conversation is, giving us tent poles for the off season, and getting your Bears juices flowing on a Friday in June.
We're less than a month away from training camp.
Goodness. I mean, I think it's baseball season.
Totally baseball season.
And I also think it's NBA draft season. And I think the listeners might deserve a little NHL draft talk. Have they been nice so far?
They have. And here's what I'll tell you.
What?
There's a the top of the NHL draft is filled with centers.
You're giving it to them.
Yeah.
Look at that.
And the Blackhawks are in a really good position where they can land.
Can we still say Blackhawks? We can say that one.
Yes,
right?
We can.
Urlacher should have called them the Commanders in the open.
Brian is definitely not going to call them the Commanders. And if you were watching the video, if you were looking at the cap that he had on, it would explain probably why.
Oh.
But regardless.
Was it red?
Regardless okay. of that. Right. It wasn't, but it might as well have been.
Got you.
I think that the Blackhawks are in a really good position to get some help from the center position. And the way that the draft is going to fall, there's an opportunity for them to get a couple of players, a couple of guys that could fall to them where they're at three. It's going to be fine. I think the Blackhawks are poised to have a very strong draft. I still think that they're at least three or four major players away from being good. That's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's good stuff. Do you know how many players selected in the entire draft last year played in an NHL game last year?
How many players drafted played in an NHL game?
Last year. Just to give you an idea.
How many total drafted?
Total players drafted who played in an NHL game last year. Five.
I was going to say 10.
The answer is five. So that's why it's hard to wrap your head around, sort of like the MLB draft, to wrap your head around just how far away some of these guys are. But when you're up towards the top like they are at three, and you hope not to be up there very often again, there is a chance that they get somebody who can help them quickly. And even if he doesn't, obviously, you can think about him as a prospect and get excited about it.
Yeah.
I was reading about the forward, Michael Misa, the Canadian, big, big dude, who can obviously play some center, but also maybe some wing. But like he might fall to them at three because the team at two is in love with a kid from Finland.
Yeah, but there are some mocks that have San Jose taking Misa and Frondell being the person who falls to the Blackhawks at number three. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of options there, and they're in a good spot.
So Sweden, not Finland. I'm so sorry.
Man, you messed that up.
I know. I'm pissed
off.
How
are people going to take us as serious as a hockey show if you don't know the difference between Sweden and Finland?
I'll tell you how they're going to take us seriously, because
they're not inviting you to the Four Nations Cup.
Because I was part of the Scores Blackhawks heyday, covering three Hawk wins, was on the ice with the team after the win in Philly.
You stole a marsh peg.
And I did that after the win in Boston. I was on the ice after 17
and then
seconds.
Matt Abatacola stole it from you.
Right, he did. And then he returned it in a very honorable gesture many years later. But I've got bona fides, man. I sang songs about Duncan Keith.
All right, you should probably stop now.
I sang songs about Antti Niemi, who said no. We got bona fides,
Uncle
man.
Auntie?
Yeah.
I literally hosted Blackhawks postgame shows.
See?
On the Score.
There you go.
But people don't remember that.
You've done that?
Yeah.
I mean,
we did remotes with Big Buff. God, those were fun shows.
Yeah. Dustin Byfuglien was so much fun, man. Because
Duncan Byfuglien.
You know what's crazy about it too, Tanny? Is that there's a through line for the Miller Lite top draft shows. He and Martellus, very similar. In the fact that neither one of them wanted to talk about the sport that they played.
I could see that.
Dustin only wanted to talk about video games, getting high, and fishing. And Martellus wanted to talk about cartoons and philosophy. It was a challenge as a talk show host.
It sounds like
it made me better as a talk show host, because I'm like, how much of the actual sport are we going to talk about today? And then sometimes, like, Martellus would be like, he would want to go through, like, some stuff. And then he'd go through it, and then he'd be like, all right, now let's talk about this. And I'm like, okay.
There you go.
Go right. But Buff, every week, man.
Did the people come out to see Big Buff? Take a Blackhawk out to the Burbs with a good Blackhawk team? They were packing him in to see Big Buff.
They really were.
He was one of the best at that lovely Annette front presence. Like, he was the guy. Like, let's just put him up there. And let him move his big Byfuglien around up there and get in the way.
I like both guys quite a bit. And Buff was just fun to be around. Like, seeing how people reacted to him when he would be out in public was hilarious.
Yo, what up, Shoney?
Exactly right. They had rappers on that team.
Look at that.
It's a whole thing.
All right, Textures, congrats. You were nice enough, and we delivered a little NHL draft conversation.
Yeah, I think it's important, and congratulations to Duncan Keith for making the Hall of Fame, and congratulations to Jonathan Toews for hopefully making it back to playing for his hometown Winnipeg Jets.
Yeah, I mean, good for him for finding a purpose again in playing and wanting to get back into it. It's a fascinating journey. I'd love to know more of the ins and outs of that process for him.
And that concludes your Blackhawks segment.
A lot of the listeners had not heard about Operation Woo King Tuck. And boy, it's just getting started again, thanks to those comments to Mike Berman. But it's time now to play the game. It's been weeks and weeks.
Yeah, we should do it every week.
I think we should.
Whoa.
Categories is next on the score.
Spiegel and Holmes.
You know, we call today Feel Good Friday, so I'm trying to stick to that, you know?
I like it.
Afternoons on the Score.
So, I think it's time to play the game.
We're playing the game?
Yes, we're playing the game.
Do we have to play the game?
What's the game?
The game is categories.
It really is. We haven't played it in weeks and weeks.
Ba-da-da-ba-ba-da-ba-da.
But it's time. One of us is the host, and that person brings up three different categories, one by one, of course. That otherwise would be chaos. Two of them are usually sports. One non-sports, but having to do with something that came up on the show during the week. And you play along in your cubicle, in your car, wherever. And the host today is Alex Kuhn.
Hello. What's up, guys?
That's Spiegel's bit. That's Spiegel's bit. Stop that.
Nobody says hello.
I thought he was going to do voices and characters with that at some point.
Who, me?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought Alex.
No,
Alex got to do voices.
No, but at the beginning of the show, you had kind of promised that there was going to be a Urethra Franklin.
Oh, okay. All right, next week, I promise. Each day next week will be a different character.
Well, until then, let's play some categories. Let's remind people of the rules. I got two sports-related categories. We're going to go around the room.
Yep.
I also have a non-sports-related category. Yep. These are timely, they are topical, and we are going to start with the fact that the big dumper, Cal Raleigh, has 32 home runs this year before the All-Star break. There are 14 players in Major League Baseball that have hit at least 32 home runs before the All-Star break. Five players have done it more than once. So we are going to start with Tanny, and we're going to go around the room. 32 home runs or more before the All-Star break.
This is in the history of the game?
In the history of the game.
Ken Griffey Jr.
Ken Griffey Jr. is correct. He is actually one that has done it twice.
Is it me next?
Lawrence, you're next.
Sammy Sosa.
Sammy Sosa, correct. Also done it twice.
How about Aaron Judge?
Aaron Judge is correct. He has done it twice as well.
That was scary.
Tanny.
Throw it back to 1994, Matt Williams.
Matt Williams is correct. 1994, and he called his shot with the year. Tanny is impressive.
One of the worst years of my life.
Lawrence.
Mark McGwire.
Mark McGwire is correct once again.
Wow.
He has done it. He did it twice as well. 1987, 1998.
So we're 32 homers before the break.
Yes.
Is the category. How about... how about Babe Ruth?
Babe Ruth is incorrect.
Yeah, I deserve that. Do-da.
Did we say Barry Bonds yet?
No. We've not said Barry Bonds yet. Correct.
Alex Rodriguez.
Alex Rodriguez is incorrect.
Ah!
So Tanny for the win.
Oh, man. I'm just Roger Maris.
Oh, I like that answer.
Roger Maris is correct.
Yeah!
He had 33 home runs in 1961. The other answers, Chris Davis had 37 in 2013.
Wait, which Chris Davis?
The white one from Baltimore.
Yeah, Crash Davis had 37 in 2013. Reggie Jackson, 37 in 1969.
Wow.
Of course, Luis Gonzalez, 35 in 2001. Frank Howard, 34 in 1969. Albert Pujols, 32 in 2009. And guys, Frank Thomas, 1994.
Oh, wow. That's right, him and Matt Williams.
Strikes short and...
Tanny, congrats. You're Mr. Baseball. You get to host Hit and Run on Sunday morning.
Yay! Can I put on Ronji?
Yes.
Hold on.
Yes. All right, we got Ronji, Herb, Barry Rosner, Joe Ostrowski.
Well,
efforting.
Tanny, you win the
Fast
first baseball.
Havarkis.
First baseball category. We have a second baseball category.
Wow.
And Clayton Kershaw, three strikeouts away from being the 20th player with 3,000 career strikeouts. I have a list of the other 19.
Ooh.
Lawrence, we will start with you.
Nolan Ryan.
Nolan Ryan, number one. Correct.
Walter Johnson.
Walter Johnson is number nine. Correct.
Randy Johnson.
Number two.
Tom Seaver.
Number six.
Steve Carlton.
Number four, correct.
Bob Gibson.
That is correct. I'm going to find him here. He's number 16.
Pedro Martinez.
Number 15, correct.
Greg Maddux.
Number 12, correct.
Tom Glavine.
Tom Glavine is incorrect.
Oh, I'm going to go back to my Greek yogurt. Cassie Carlson would hate it.
Lord.
Sandy Koufax.
Not enough games.
Sandy Koufax is incorrect.
Oh, damn it. If my the next guess I was going to make is on the list, I'd be so mad at myself.
For the win.
Roger Clemens.
Roger Clemens is correct. Number three.
Is Dwight Gooden on the list?
Dwight Gooden is not on the list.
All right, then I would have been out anyway.
Is John Smoltz on that list?
So we're going to go Burt Blyleven, number five. Don Sutton, number seven. Gaylord Perry, eight. Justin Verlander, 10.
Woo!
Max Scherzer, 11.
Woo!
Phil Niekro, 13.
That's racist name.
Fergie Jenkins, 14. Kurt Schilling, 17. Oh. CeCe Sabathia, yes. 18. John Smoltz.
Had Schilling on here. 19. Dope.
Yeah. Good category. That was fun.
That's really good. All right. So the non-sports category.
Yeah. Non-sports related category. Of course, this time of year, a lot of people traveling around the country. It is summertime. Summertime shy. Here I have got Flix North America's top 15 most searched destinations in North America for 2025. So the top 15 most searched North American destinations for summer 2025. And ooh. I believe, Speegs, we are going to start with you.
All right, let me just wrap my head around the category. These are places, geographical places.
Yes. And they are cities.
Oh, they're cities and not like things.
That's what I was trying to get at.
Okay.
So
I got
cities,
you.
These are...
Now, yes. Cities and there's one that is an attraction and also a city.
Okay.
Okay. That would probably be Disney World, Orlando, Florida.
Well, Orlando, Florida is one of them. Okay. It is number 12.
Disney World is not a city, Matt, okay? Although it basically
is. That's the attraction. That's the attraction.
It's more of a country.
An attraction like I have for you, Chris.
San Diego.
San Diego, somehow, not on the list.
Oh, no.
I don't understand this list either.
I knew I should have said Traverse City, Michigan.
That's for you.
Chicago, Illinois.
Chicago, Illinois, number 7. Speaks.
Summer destinations. Let's go to New York, shall
number
we?
Number one all on right. the list.
Lawrence, you and I.
I have an attraction, but it's... I'm going to guess the Grand Canyon.
That is incorrect.
Damn it!
I thought that was
but
a fine guess.
I like where you're going there.
Wow. Hot out there.
So San Diego and Grand Canyon equals bad by these people searching
good,
things.
Good job,
too hot.
Flix. Way
too
to go.
Hot. Yeah.
Very reputable source, normally.
Oh, yeah. Flix. Is that with a YX? What is that?
Triple
X.
Flix, that sounds like a movie website. What are you doing?
And it's for the win, Speaks.
And it's not bad. Like, the southern rim of the Grand Canyon this time of year is totally fine.
How about Los Angeles, California?
Los Angeles, California, number 3.
Okay. Absurd.
It's ridiculous.
What? That is ridiculous. Right.
Well, what about like Cape Cod, Nantucket? I was going to go there next. Are those there?
See, that's the thing. Like, I think of summertime as an opportunity to go to those northern places that are lovely
well,
in the summer.
What else the attraction, is on the list? The attraction I was speaking of, Niagara Falls.
I was going to
number 13. Slowly I turn.
Yeah. Number 2, Toronto.
I was going to guess Toronto.
Number 4, Boston.
Yeah.
Number 5.
Is Montreal on the list?
No.
It is for me.
Number 5, D.C. Number 6, Atlanta. 8, Philly.
Atlanta.
9, Las Vegas. 10 and 11, Houston and Dallas.
That sounds like a really bad list.
Niagara Falls, 13. I can't help what people are searching.
Oh, you're right.
Number 14, Miami. And yes, Lawrence, number 15,
boring.
Montreal,
you're boring,
Quebec.
Everybody. Quit boring, everyone.
Alex, it would have been better off if you would have just said, in my opinion, in Alex Kuhn's opinion, these are my favorite destinations to search.
What about a little more credibility? You're fired. You're fired as the host of Category.
Well, guess what, Speaks? You're rehired as the host of next week's Category.
I look forward to resuming. We almost made Alex the permanent host of Categories. Not today. It's not happening today, mister. All right. Whew. Man, we survived.
That was pretty good Categories,
yeah,
Alex.
Yeah, it was pretty fun.
The baseball ones were fantastic and timely. So.
And the last one sucked, and that also is good. That also can be very entertaining.
Sometimes when it sucks, it's good.
That's exactly right. It's the genius of the game. Lawrence came up with it. Yesterday, I was upset about the Bulls draft because I watched round one.
Did you watch round two?
No, but Lawrence Holmes did, and he's upset about round two.
I'm not as upset about round two. I'm just upset about the Bulls overall.
Let's hear it next on Spiegel and Holmes on The Score.
Spiegel and Holmes.
You guys are friends of the program, man. I can never turn y'all down.
I know that's right. That's Stacey King.
The friends of the program are my friends, and they are friends for life.
Afternoons on The Score.
Getting back to you and these damn Chicago Bulls.
Yeah, Stephen A., these damn Chicago Bulls. I think that what happened to me is after sitting in the room with you yesterday, Matt Spiegel, you know, I was kind of already down about the Bulls. And then you got mad, and I'm sitting there going, well, all right, let's see what they do in round two. Maybe they'll take a risk with someone that doesn't kind of fit their profile, because that's what you can do in the second round. In the second round, you can go, all right, let's take a flyer on a guy. And they didn't. They took exactly the type of guy that we expect them to. He's young and he's international and he's probably not going to play here.
He's another project.
Yeah.
He's a guy who they signed and he's going to be a two-way, right? He's going to be in the G League and we don't know how much or if at all he's going to end up playing next year. Lachlan Ulbrich from Australia.
I get it. Second round picks, it's rare to have a story like Io, and that's why his story is so cool. This is what Jeremy Wu, who's one of the NBA writers for ESPN, said about Ulbrich. Chicago traded the number 45 pick with the Lakers for cash and grabbed Ulbrich. He's a physical big man who's among the better players at the NBA Combine, which helped pave his way into the draft. Ulbrich doesn't offer much on offense, nor is he a big-time shot blocker. But it's easy to appreciate how hard he plays.
Okay. I mean, I saw, like, you can dream on these guys.
He's a throwback big.
Yeah, it's somebody, I think it was Bleacher Report, was trying to comp him to a Domantas Sabonis in training, in that he can pass and he can dribble a little bit.
Sabonis can also score.
Yeah, he can really score.
And my thing is that, okay, it is the second round, and there are a lot of question marks once you get past probably player 20, but I would have been fine with the Bulls taking a swing at R.J. Lewis, for example, who didn't get drafted. And his stock, like, fell apart during the tournament when Pitino had to bench him. But that's a 6'7 wing that can score. Or Mark Sears from Alabama, who's teeny tiny and he's old, but I know what he can do. I know that he can score and I know that he can shoot.
Yeah, we
like Chucky Hepburn out of Louisville.
How about Will Richard? You like Will Richard?
Absolutely.
I really like Will Richard out of Florida. I think he went the next pick, actually, at 56.
It's amazing. Like, there were other guys out there that you go, this guy would have made sense if you didn't want to, if you didn't. Coleman Hawkins is another guy where you go, okay, 6'10".
That's the former Illinois kid who transferred.
Mm-hmm.
And also the same name as one of the great jazz saxophonists of all time.
It just, like, every time that we talk about the Bulls and, like, the draft, it just kind of comes back to, oh, all right, well.
Because other teams know what they're doing in the second round. Like, they even make a...
The Lakers!
The Lakers traded up from 55 to 45 with the Bulls.
For cash.
And then they traded up again from 45 to 36 for cash. The Lakers simply used cash to move up 19 spots in the second round and then get somebody... This what, a 6'8 slasher who can really finish at the rim, who like is going to be part of their rotation probably right away. So, but anyway, they had an idea and they went up and they got somebody. And the Bulls traded down and took somebody who's not going to see the court.
Let me ask you this question because we haven't really talked about it and it was the news of earlier today in the NBA. If you're Michael Reinsdorf, now that Masai Ujiri is available, do you make a phone call?
I mean, there's logic, and then there's what seemingly has already happened in terms of extensions for AK and Eversley and Donovan. So I mean, Masai Ujiri is a really legendary NBA executive. With deep-seated ties to African basketball now that could benefit you, along with obviously more than a decade of experience in Toronto and building a title team with them after they traded away DeMar DeRozan. Of course. But Masai Ujiri might want to try and bottom out and restart and imprint his own vision on a franchise, and this franchise doesn't seem like they want anybody to do that.
But the thing is that at least he has the bona fides to back up. Like, I think it'd be easier for Bulls fans to be like, oh, well, yeah, this guy's resume says that he knows what he's doing, where the resume and the work that the guys have put in front of us says they're just kind of waiting. Like, they're just in it. And it's not, there isn't anything to kind of hold on to as a fan and say, yeah, this is the direction. They just tread water.
Yeah, they really do. And I myself am still in a place where when it comes to the first round draft pick, the Frenchman, it's like I'm sitting at a cafe with a beret and I'm smoking a cigarette and I have ennui. I'm not interested. I'm eating one of those delicious French croissants. And the eggs, I've heard the eggs are unbelievable there. And I don't care about the Frenchman. And I feel bad. It's not his fault.
It's not on him.
It's not on him, Noah. It is not on you. I'll find it. Before Summer League, I will find the interest to get up to speed on you and think about you as the long-term project.
Yeah, Summer League schedule just came out. The Bulls will play Friday night and Saturday night.
Are you going, or is this just another trip you talk about taking and don't take?
I might.
I think he answered the question, Alex. I think he answered the question.
I was thinking the exact same
thing. I did have fourth.
We have an update on 4th of July yet?
Put in a credential for me.
We will check in next hour on the chase for disgrace that Lawrence Holmes has threatened to make, and we just don't know if it's going to happen or not.
We'll see.
We might have to kick in some money to make sure it happens. Well, he doesn't need that. Got new paper.
I think I'm good.
That car you're driving says you are.
It's a nice car.
I know.
I only drive it on the weekends.
Did you get $1 million deal?
He did, Joe Kelly.
I mean,
he did.
It's nice.
I mean,
it's pretty nice. Yeah. I'll just say that.
Good for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And thanks for the chairs.
Thank you. I wanted to make sure the crew was taken care of, too.
It was my favorite thing you put in your deal was new chairs. For us.
We needed new chairs.
I know. I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know it was a thing that you could put stuff like that in your deal and they would deliver it. Until I saw Ryan Porth walking the hallways looking for chairs.
Got to take care of the crew, too.
Yeah, you did.
Let's talk more Bulls. Keith Smith is going to join us. I am looking forward to hearing his thoughts on the Bulls front office.
Yeah, and we can obviously do some other NBA with him because he knows national stuff very well. And this isn't front office insider, so we can talk about the nuts and bolts of running a team.
We could ask him if Masai Ujiri should be a phone call that Michael Reinsdorf makes. Next, here on The Score.